First, it's never been easier to see a documentary, regardless of where you live. Netflix has played a big role in pushing the genre forward with documentary series like the popular Making a Murderer and full-length films. Hulu is making strides as well. And a few documentaries have found success on the big screen this summer, like Won't You Be My Neighbor, an ode to children's show star Mr. Rogers. The documentary is no longer just for cinephiles and history buffs. Nick Shager is a film critic and culture writer. His work appears in publications like Yahoo Entertainment, The Daily Beast, Esquire, and more. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, I've seen some people out there, Nick, making the case that we're in maybe some kind of golden age for documentaries with different outlets picking them up. Do you see that?
I do. I think we are in a great moment right this year and even last year. And that is both because of a relationship between the theaters and the streaming services, which, you know, has only just started to flourish. Documentaries, I think, had a big moment in the early 2000s and then sort of tapered off a bit theatrically. But the streaming services have stepped in to, you know, sort of bolster that by releasing a whole slew of both feature-length documentaries as well as TV series. And that, in turn, has, I think, reignited interest in documentaries to the point that now we're seeing them make a comeback at the box office, which we've seen certainly this summer, thanks to films like RBG and Won't You Be My Neighbor.
Were documentaries for a while there a hard sell, given that, you know, they might be on only so many screens, there's a lot of competition for real estate in theaters? Was it just hard for documentary filmmakers to get money to see the light of day?
I think it has to do with, the demand versus the number of theaters that are playing them. I think across the country, we've seen a dwindling or a number of art houses increasingly closed down in competition, you know, boxed out by the competition from multiplexes and the major studio releases. I'm located here in New York City, and we've just had one of our most prominent art houses that has spearheaded art house cinema for decades close down. I think as a result, it was very hard to get a documentary to not only play in a theater, but to stay in a theater, because there have been a number of documentaries vying for a very small number of screens. Now, however, we're seeing that there's some sort of revival there, as I said, because I think streaming services have given people a taste of a wide variety of documentaries, and that in turn has shown that there is still an appetite for it if you can get the right documentary out there on the right number of screens.
Now, documentary films never went away, and some people had big success, like Michael Moore since the 90s, Morgan Spurlock, the Super Size Me and his follow-ups to that, Errol Morris and others. But did those big high-profile successes kind of bring the documentary genre along with them in those days?
I think that, you know, Michael Moore in the late 90s and early 2000s, along with Jeffrey Blitz, who made a documentary called Spellbound about a spelling bee competition, and as you said, Morgan Spurlock with Super Size Me, really spearheaded a mainstreaming of documentary cinema. Those were really sort of pop-oriented documentaries. They had wide appeal. They had very easy, sort of catchy premises to bring audiences in. But the problem there is sort of Michael Moore and Morgan Spurlock are very big personalities themselves, and they were sort of part of what helped sell those films. It was hard for a lot of other documentaries to sort of match that. And I think what you wound up was having a situation where, at least in terms of box office and in terms of wide appeal, documentaries sort of tapered off a bit. Until now, we've seen, this year in particular, if you can get a documentary into a theater with a big personality, say Mr. Rogers or Ruth Bader Ginsburg, audiences are really interested in seeing personalities that they know and that they love, and seeing really in-depth nonfiction portraits of them.
For those movies maybe without that big personality, are the streaming services helping them find their audience, and vice versa, the audience you know, that might not have been able to go to a big city to see it on the two screens it was on, now they can find that more specialized documentary?
Absolutely. Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu have been enormous in terms of getting a wide variety of documentaries out to an amazingly large audience. As you said, people who don't live in New York and L.A., don't have nearly the options, even in theaters, for documentaries as others. And so you wind up with a situation where Netflix, the documentaries just show up on your television, you know, on a given Friday. That really has allowed the streaming services to cater to a wide audience by doing a number of different types of things, including, as we've seen, especially with Netflix, true crime, which is, has just been an enormous draw for them, and has, I think, really sort of helped reignite interest in documentaries in general over the last 2-3 years.
We're talking to Nick Shager, film critic and culture writer. He is telling us about the rise, the rebirth in some ways, of documentaries in the age of streaming services. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen a good documentary lately, a new one, or maybe an older one that you want to share a recommendation for? Where do you go to find documentaries? Have you gotten into them or back into them lately? Call 800-642-1234. Nick, you wrote a piece for Esquire, the best 10 documentaries of 2018 so far. Tell us a couple that are at the top of your list.
Yeah, the top of my list is a film, actually, that's sort of a documentary hybrid called 24 Frames. It's by a world-famous Iranian director named Abbas Kiarostami. He passed away a couple of years ago, and this was his final film. It is a series of actually 24 still photos that he sort of brings to life in animated form. It's a really beautiful, sort of challenging meditation on mortality and on the cinema itself. My other one, number two on my list, is Film Worker, which is a totally different type of film. It is a portrait of a man named Leon Vitali, who for decades was Stanley Kubrick's right-hand man. And so the film is both this fascinating study of sort of the genius behind the genius, and also a study in obsession and what that can do to you when you dedicate your entire life to somebody else's vision. Both of those are a little out of the ordinary. So is my number three film, Bisbee 17, which is a fascinating documentary that just came out about a tragedy that took place in Bisbee, Arizona in 1917 that involves a lot of issues having to do with immigration and intolerance that make it a very relevant story today. Those coupled with, as we've said, the big hits, Won't You Be My Neighbor, and RBG, also a film called Minding the Gap, which was out on Hulu recently. All of those films are really great. It really has made it a banner year for documentaries.
And those and others on your list really highlight the diversity of documentaries. Because I think when people hear documentary, or I'll speak for myself, when I hear documentary, I think, oh, it's something that's going to focus in on one issue or one period of history, or maybe it's a biography. And it sounds like you're saying there's a lot of range here in terms of a form, experimentation on some of these, and content. There's just a lot more going on out there.
There is. There's really a wide variety. The films we've been talking about that are the big hits of the summer are Won't You Be My Neighbor, RBG, and another documentary called Three Identical Strangers, all of which have really great mainstream appeal because they have great personalities at their center, or they have great, fascinating real-life stories that, you know, are sort of almost like page-turners in a certain sense. Three Identical Strangers plays almost like a thriller in certain regards and a mystery. At the same time, there are a lot of other films out there that do challenge the form and do sort of unique things with them. And I don't think, you know, documentary filmmakers and documentary fans have to necessarily settle for them. These films, a lot of them wind up on your streaming services. A film like Minding the Gap, which is on Hulu, it's a Hulu documentary original. It's about three young kids who grew up in Rockford, Illinois as skateboarders. And their story is this fascinating story that eventually winds up being a story not only about economic disadvantages, but about sort of a domestic abuse. And so there's a really wide variety. And the great thing about documentaries is it gives you this amazingly diverse view of life itself. And so, you know, this year in particular has proven that to be the case.
Let's give a listen to the trailer from the one you were just talking about, Minding the Gap. Three teenage boys from Illinois find their sense of self and family in skateboarding.
Take one.
I'm making this film because I saw myself in your story.
I always felt like I didn't fit in with my family.
My parents ran this very controlling house. I ran away a lot.
skateboarding is more of a family than my family.
How did you get disciplined?
I mean, well, they call it child abuse now, but...
Life might be moving too fast. We have to fully grow up, and it's gonna suck.
When you're a kid, you just do, you just act. And then somewhere along the line, everyone loses that.
It's one of the things that documentaries can do, Nick. Maybe take these characters who might be stock characters in everyday life. Oh, there's some kids skateboarding. And look at the world through their point of view.
Yeah, there's a real nuance to documentary filmmaking when it's done at its finest that really is sort of almost unparalleled when you have real access to these unique individuals, even though they seem like kids you've seen a million times before in a million movies or seen in your community or seen on your streets. A film like Minding the Gap really lets you in to not only see their home lives and their personal relationships, but gets a sense of their interior lives. And, it, you know, when done at its finest, a film like Minding the Gap is really, you know, illuminating for not just a specific person or people, but about the human condition in general.
We're talking to film critic Nick Shager. We're talking about the rising popularity and availability now of documentaries. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you new to documentary watching? What's one you've watched and liked, maybe would recommend? What makes a documentary interesting to you? And has a streaming of some sort, a Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, whatever, exposed you to more documentaries? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Nick Shager, a film critic and culture writer whose work appears in The Daily Beast, Esquire, Yahoo Entertainment, and more, talking about documentary movies and their journey to mainstream success and their availability on streaming services and how that's changing the game. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you watch documentaries? What are you looking for? What are you recommending? Call in or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Shia is with us in Madison. Shia, hi.
Hi. I tuned in to Central Time right at the right moment, getting ready for a new season of On Wisconsin locally in Madison. So, I got roped into filmmaking myself with a small film crew here, and it's really expanding out here. And, you know, I'm working on a documentary myself, and I never thought I'd be a filmmaker. But this Get Loud International Artists on Board documentary expose is going to be a really cool one. And what inspired me is I was looking for a film to watch, and I went to Four Star Video and just checked out. You know, I just like the title of it, Something Ventured. And I put it in, and, you know, it's this documentary about the original venture capitalists and, like, this small group of people that, you know, went to fund, just little companies, Cisco, IBM, Apple, I don't know, Atari, but it was all these, like, you know, it was just this idea of people allying their skills together.
I gotcha, Shia. Your phone line's breaking up a little bit, but Shia is going into making a documentary himself, Nick, and he mentioned a long-time Wisconsin video store. There are still video stores out there. How important were they in keeping documentaries alive over the years?
I think they were vital at the time because, like many other sort of smaller genres, so to speak, they had the same amount of visibility on the shelves. One of the things that happened with the disappearance of video stores, at least initially, was there was no way to really get them in front of people or to make people, aware that they existed. I think that has now changed with the streaming services because everybody can just log on and go search under, the documentary categories, and that really aids things. But we had a period there in between the end of video stores and the real rise of streaming here where people were renting things over Netflix, by disc, through the mail, and that was a much harder way to discover things than it is today.
Shia, thanks for the call. Good luck with your own documentary effort. I will go now to Jim in Rhinelander. Jim, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
I watched two documentaries probably last year on Netflix. I enjoyed both of them. The first one was called Valley Uprising, and it was about the whole climbing culture in the Yosemite Valley. Even though I don't climb, I found it fascinating. So it started with the original group probably in the 50s when it became popular, and it followed the whole activity up until the modern era. I think this was done in like 2015 maybe. So it was really fascinating. I can't believe some of the stuff these guys do nowadays. And the other one that I really enjoyed, it was called Damnation, and it was a documentary on some of the high-profile dams that have been, you know, installed on our river systems in the country and the negative impacts they are having on the resource and what they took away from the native people as far as their fishing grounds and things like that. It was a very interesting documentary and well worth the watch.
Jim, thanks for the call. Valley Uprising and Damnation are his recommendations. And Nick, he found those on Netflix. And I imagine with the algorithms and whatnot, once you start liking one documentary, that's going to start exposing you to more, right?
Absolutely. In an ideal situation, the more you watch of a given genre, the more the algorithm should find other things for you. And certainly I know from my own experience, watching a lot of true crime on Netflix, half of the selections Netflix shows me now are other true crime things. So it should work.
Jim, thanks for the call. Go next to Jerry with us in Glendale. Jerry, hi.
Good afternoon. All of us are looking forward to September 21st when Fahrenheit 9/11 is going to be released. We're great big fans of Michael Moore in the Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha area. He had his second debut of Roger and Me in Kenosha. And I'd just like to know from the guest if he's seen it. And then I'd like to get the name of that arts house that closed in New York City and where, what borough or neighborhood it might be in.
Jerry, thanks for the call. The new one is Fahrenheit 11/9 by Michael Moore, right, Nick?
That's right. Yeah, that's it's going to be the sort of companion piece to Fahrenheit 9/11, which was obviously about the Bush administration back in 2004. Fahrenheit 11/9 is specifically about Donald Trump's presidency and the 2016 election that led to it. That has just premiered at the Toronto Film Festival. Unfortunately, I'm not at the Toronto Film Festival, so I've yet to see it. I know there's been a mixed reaction to it, but then there usually is a mixed reaction to Michael Moore films. As for the art house that closed here, it was Lincoln Plaza Cinemas, which was the Upper West Side epicenter of art house cinema here in New York City. It just closed a couple of months ago, and I believe they are working on getting somebody else to take over the operation of an art house up there, but so far, nothing doing.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to film critic Nick Shager about the state of documentaries these days. I want to go back to one that was on your list, one of the bigger hits now, the one on Mr. Rogers. Here's a listen to that trailer.
A television program for children made its unauspicious debut on station WQED in Pittsburgh. Its host, Fred Rogers.
Mr. Rogers?
Yeah.
I want to tell you something.
What would you like to tell
me? I like you,
my dear. Thank you very much for telling me that.
You take all of the elements that make good television and do the exact opposite. You have Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Low production values, simple set, unlikely star. Yet it worked.
Hello.
I've always felt that I didn't need to put on a funny hat or jump through the hoop to have a relationship with a child.
So what is it in 2018, Nick, do you think that's making a Mr. Rogers documentary such a hit?
I think Mr. Rogers and Won't You Be My Neighbor has been the beneficiary of not only all the things we've been talking about, but of timing. I do think that there has been, it is proven that there is an appetite out there for films that are run counter to the daily news cycle, which has been, I think, wearying for a lot of people over the last year or two. And here we have, and not just wearying, but very divisive. There's been a lot of anger. There's been a lot of conflict. I think here you have a documentary that is not only about somebody everybody grew up with and loved, but
somebody whose story is really a celebration of goodness and the value of goodness and kindness and compassion, not just on an individual level, but on a cultural level. And that has really resounded. I mean, the movie has made over $22 million at the box office, which for a documentary is really unheard of. So clearly it's speaking to something, some sort of need that moviegoers were looking for.
And Nick, before we run out of time, you mentioned that you watch a fair amount of true crime documentaries. Do you have one you would point people toward who want to check out that genre of documentary?
I do. I think that if people are looking at our Netflix subscribers, there's a wealth of choices. But one that really stood out this year and that just won an Emmy in the last day or two is a series called Wild Wild Country. It is a story about an Indian sort of cult that appeared in the Pacific Northwest in 1981 and sort of tried to take over the region and wound up getting into a big fight with the local community and then the state government and city government. It's a fascinating story. It's one that I didn't know about, even though I certainly lived through it. And I think it winds up getting into a lot of issues that are still relevant today while also providing you with a really fascinating portrait of not just sort of out there religious groups, but it has in this woman named Ma Anand Sheela, the second in command of the cult, a really fascinating sort of villain for people to really root against.
We'll leave it there for now. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Nick Shager, film critic and culture writer. You can check out more of his top picks in his piece for Esquire. It's called The Best Documentaries of 2018 so far. We've been talking about the rebirth in some ways of documentaries.